Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer, the owner and lead writer. Joining me is my co-host and artist for Smugbeat Games, Kenneth Holm.
Hey there.
And our guest this week is the designer and owner of Mousechief, the creator for Dangerous High School Girls in Trouble and the recent release Seven Grand Steps, Keith Nemitz.
Hey there. How's it going?
Great. How is everything going with you, Keith, this week?
Pretty crazy, pretty hectic. I've been trying to get the Steam cards together so that they'll accept them. I've also been preparing builds for other portals to try and sell to casual gamers.
So you're actually going to get Steam cards for Seven Grand Steps?
Yeah, hopefully we'll be up in a week or so. I just got word back that they seem to be just trying to decide when to release them.
So how did that process actually start? When did they actually mail you about the system?
Well, that was probably a month ago, and because I was still sort of like dealing with launch issues, I didn't jump on it right away, and now I wish I had, because I probably could have made the Steam sale, and it might have made a big difference during the Steam sale.
Yeah, this Steam sale has been pretty crazy with all the Steam cards. I know that my friends and I have been, scrambling to trade all our cards. I just got the really big 10-card badge yesterday from just concentrates with my friends.
Right.
That's a good strategy.
Go ahead.
So, Keith, before we get started with the general cast, what I like to always ask for any new developers on is, could you talk a little bit about your company and the games that you like to make?
My company started in about 2003, and all of my games have been heavily narrative-focused, but the gameplay has varied a lot. The first game I made was The Witch's Yarn, which was an IGF finalist in 2006, and it was sort of like a comic book theater, and you were the director. You would actually cue people and items into the scene, and then they'd respond to that. That was the clever trick of that game. It was played like a sitcom, though, as far as the storytelling. And after that, it was the Dangerous High School Girls in Trouble, which was a light RPG, very heavily story-based about the girls in the 1920s and all their crazy town antics. And, of course, Seven Grand Steps is a little more mature. It's about the ancient period of history, and you're guiding a family lineage through it to see if that family line can survive all the crazy, harsh things that caused ages to rise and fall.
Yep, and we're going to talk about that one later in the cast, because that's been a very interesting game. So I was looking at your profile on the Mousechief site, and you've been actually in the game industry for a pretty long time. You've been working for, I think, Sierra Online. And we talked a little bit before the cast that you worked at 3DO, not exactly in their games department, but just like generally working at the company.
I was working on their games for a PC and then later for PS2. So we did a couple of the Army Men titles, and I worked on one of their little action titles for the PC that really didn't go anywhere, but neither did 3DO.
Yeah, sadly. I remember actually playing the Army Men games. I think I have like one or two of them from way back then.
I like the franchise, but the company itself had difficulty, organizing themselves such that they recognized gameplay. It was very much a charisma-oriented company. If you could convince others that your game was good, even if it wasn't, you'd be able to make a game. It was a really harsh lesson that I kind of struggled with, because I was hoping to present some of my ideas, and I just couldn't get traction because I just didn't have that kind of I was too nerdy.
Not a pitch man?
I can barely survive with what I've got now with my own company. It's so hard for me to like actually say my game is good to people, because I can think of all the flaws.
Yeah, I'm not a big pitch man either, but I sort of had to put that hat on since I started Game Wisdom myself.
I'm all about inflating things. Mission accomplished.
You're hired.
Good. I like it.
Yeah, I actually do own a 3DO system. I still have it hooked up from time to time. And it was not, I wouldn't say it was like a horrible system. It was sort of like that in between like the Sega Saturn and what eventually became like the PlayStation 1 era. But it never really got off the ground. They had some pretty interesting games, but this was during that time where I think we had like 5 or 6 different hardwares competing with each other. And the market was just really stretching 6 different ways.
Yeah, and it was kind of ahead of its time as far as trying to get 3D working right. I think Rescue on Fractalus was part of that, and was a ball blazer, was from LucasArts. And then actually I worked at a different company, Digital Pictures, and we did this weird video-based football game called Quarterback Attack, and I know it was ported to the 3DO. I was doing the Mac port.
That must have been pretty brutal doing the Mac port. How was that experience, by the way?
Well, that was back when it was a 25 megahertz PowerPC processor, and it was pretty crazy trying to get the video to run at speed and then throw like massive sprites on the screen as well, because they still didn't have a pixel doubler at that time, so we were fighting with four times the number of pixels to try and get the same sort of effect as a PC could push.
Good gravy. That must have been a brutal experience.
It's a fun challenge. That's definitely, I worked really hard at that company, but it was like the best company I ever worked for too, so I didn't mind. It was so strange that like after they collapsed, which is a different story, that I just didn't realize how much I burned myself out.
Well, I think, you know, like the challenge and the experience was new and everything was cutting edge then, you know?
I think everything still is cutting edge. It's kind of funny that now that we're in mobile, you know, a lot of the lessons I learned in very constrained hardware circumstances have kind of come back, but mobile has accelerated much faster than PC ever did. Definitely. So I don't know when it's going to converge.
So are you one of the believers that mobile is going to take over everything?
Well, it's definitely going to be a dominant market force. I don't think PCs will go away per se. I think they're just used in different circumstances that people still need to use them for. I don't know. Maybe wearable computers like 15 years from now will be effective enough that we can just kind of like a display hovers in our face and, you know, we can just type into the air and then, you know, I can see not needing a PC then. But that's some pretty crazy stuff.
Well, we have the Google Glass coming out and we have the Oculus Rift. So we have a lot of interesting technologies that might replace it. Because our Smugbee, the company that I work for, we actually were talking about different ideas for the Oculus Rift because we actually have one for testing. And one of the things that we talked about is maybe the elimination of screens in the future. Because you ever watched Minority Report?
Oh yeah. That's everyone references that. And even Pacific Rim had the whole heads-up displays and control stuff. It was kind of fun.
Right. So instead of in the future having like six monitors you have to buy, it's expensive, it takes some space, you can just put these goggles on at a high res and create as many monitors as you want in a 3D space, right? So that would be an interesting inclusion in the future. All you need is a powerful little box that probably could be, again, resized to be wearable, and then that's all you need. You have as many screens as you need.
Yeah, and then it's a matter of input technologies, right?
Right, exactly. But things that I wonder if you can actually get, you know, 1440K displays or whatever to be cheap and to be actually running things at a proper level, because, you know, running multiple desktops like that with different programs, I don't know how that would all pan out in terms of efficiency.
Oh, well, we'll bumble along until something happens. Probably all different standards for a while.
Yeah, well, that's what I always love, is all that competition and new ideas, and that's why I'm so excited for development for VR. I think it's really coming back. I mean, did you have any experience of the 90s VR craze?
I didn't. I'm very 3D phobic in a lot of ways, but I do recognize that at some point they're going to get it right. And I've been trying to try out the Rift because I hear they got the head mount right, and then the jostle factor was killing me on everything else. And I hear they solved that by actually moving the image across the pixels to compensate. So I'm really looking forward to see how well they did it.
Yeah, I mean, if you try it, you'll really be a believer. People always look at it and think it's a gimmick. But when you try it and feel that latency, that low latency, you really start to feel like you've been transported, which is really cool. It's just that they have a low-res screen. That's the problem with the developer's kit.
And they've already announced a high-res screen, so that's good.
I mean, the screen door effect is going to still be there until they get past 1080, but, you know, it's still a big step, big step.
Yeah, with VR, I did experience it in the 90s. I did, like, I remember having to wear, like, colossal helmet on my head that, you know, broke your back while you're in, just, like, trying to shoot something. And it was interesting for the time, but it just didn't take off, I think, in part of technology, and no one really knew what to do with it. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with the Oculus Rift after all support, and with, you know, Valve game behind with, like, Team Fortress. When do you figure, Ken, that we'll start to see people develop games exclusively for the Oculus Rift?
I think we already have it. A lot of Kickstarter crowdfunded projects are coming out. Beta release games are coming out with full support for the Rift. A lot of stretch goals in crowdfunded games have Oculus Rift as one of the goals. I recently just did a game called, I think it was called Travelers, which has just that. And so I'm very excited for the future of the Rift. And I think it's all because of the low risk for the crowdfunding. These new technologies really taken off.
getting back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago with how much mobile has advanced and how the market has changed. Keith, since you have been developing games now for pretty much about, I guess, would it be over 2 decades at this point, or just 2 decades from your point of view?
Over two. I guess I started in 1992. So just, what, 21 years, does that make it?
In this industry, even like 20 years makes you old. I mean, I still remember playing Nintendo and Atari when I was like 4 or 5.
Yeah, my earliest computers were like mainframes at the high school, and then some of the very early homebrew computers playing, you know, Hammurabi and Trek and Colossal Cave.
Now, do you still have them in your collection?
Oh, I didn't own them. I was too young for that. But
okay. Because I regret throwing away some of my old computers just so I can show, like, you know, my kids in the future what they could have had, what they could have suffered with.
Check for those emulations. There's some real obsessive people wanting to preserve those technologies. So emulation has amazing abilities. There's probably an S100 bus emulation out there somewhere. That would be hilarious.
So from your point of view, being developing for over 2 decades now, I guess we talk about mobile. Were there any other major developments, I guess, digital? Like, what are your thoughts on how the industry has transitioned from a traditional retail-based format to now we have Steam, Impulse, and pretty much everyone moving away from having to go to stores to buy games?
I think it feels real natural. I mean, just because we've had internet technology long enough that eventually it just seemed like, you know, downloadable games just became a thing. You know, it wasn't very, very scary. So that's been great. I mean, I'm kind of happy for the marketplace because now I'm no longer constrained by Walmart having 6 providers of companies that they will talk to sell games to their retail space. You know, now I've got Steam that at least has, you know, a few hundred developers that they're selling for.
Yeah, I think the whole digital rise has really helped the independent market. Because I remember, wow, like early 2000, where we were still dealing with retail, and just imagine trying to have an independent market back then. It just wouldn't have been feasible due to retail costs and being, I guess, chained to the publisher format.
Yeah, it was Al Lowe, the creator of Leisure Suit Larry, who kind of like brought it home several years, maybe over a decade ago, when he was talking about how Sierra didn't really sell to the retailers. They sold to the distributors, and there were only 6 at the time. So that was their entire market, was 6 kind of like people who just looked at this stuff, didn't know what the hell it was, but knew it sold, so they'd buy some.
Did you follow the recent Kickstarter for buy-in, by the way?
Leisure Suit Larry? Oh, yeah. I had to jump in on that one. I worked with Lowe, with Larry, I'm sorry, not with Larry, with Al and Josh at Sierra, so I had to help out there.
What do you think of the game? Have you tried it?
I haven't got my copy yet. I think what? I have to look after that, figure out where it is.
Well, it looks very pretty. That's what I have to say. But I threw my hat in there, too.
I just bought one of the Leisure Suit Larry games from the big good old game sale, so I never actually played the series. Because when I was younger, I was mostly a console gamer, so I missed out on the majority of the great PC games at the time.
Personally, I actually will say I prefer the LucasArts games. I think they're just better storytelling. And Sierra could be harsh with their puzzles. I mean, literally, it was Ken Williams who said to the company, like, we make more money selling hint books than we do selling games. And I think he was serious.
Yeah, probably, with a lot of those old games. I tried King's Quest last month, the original one. And, I mean, I died like 5 times off the first screen just trying to figure out where the hell I was supposed to go.
Pretty harsh.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of the adventure games are coming back into the fray. Because we see, like, The Walking Dead winning Game of the Year. And it kind of did away with those really complex, archaic puzzles for things that just made sense in its narrative.
Oh, yeah, things like Machinarium. And I recommend the Silent Age on iPad. It's really very, very cool. And now there's the Dream Machine, which is now in its 4th thing. These are all really amazing stories being told in adventure game formats to go beyond just the Telltale stuff, which is pretty quality, I agree.
Yeah, and actually, my favorite of this generation for like independent adventure games, you ever heard of the Blackwell Legacy?
Yeah, I know Dave, and I've been following his things. I'm playing, it's not Resonance, it's the one prior to that.
Gemini Rue?
Yeah, I'm playing that right now.
Noir in space. Yeah. I really like Blackwell. He's actually said he never watched Daria before, which is that 90s sitcom with the kind of like angsty girl. Or not angsty, but like stoic character. And her main character, Blackwell, Rosangela, is so Malekith. So whenever I describe Blackwell to people, I say it's Daria with the ghost from the 1920s. And I think that's a pretty big sell, but that's still my favorite of the independent adventure games that have come out. So it's cool to know.
Getting back to some of the games that you like to make, one thing that I really find interesting about your design style is that with Dangerous High School Girls in Trouble and Seven Grand Steps, both games take place on a board game, but they feature very abstracted rules and systems that you wouldn't normally see within a board game structure. With your type of design style, when you're coming up with your concepts, do you think in terms of like a mechanics first, or do you think in terms of story and theme first?
I do think of theme first, and the only reason I've had these board game-like interfaces is that they're just inexpensive to make. They really cut down my costs. So I'm not married to them, but they've been very effective. And I like board games, too, so I kind of have that going on as well.
Are there any, besides the adventure game genre, are there any other genres that you like to play?
I really like RPGs. I'm still a fan of the earlier BioWare adventure, I'm sorry, RPGs. I'm trying to think of some of the others I've enjoyed, too. But I'm going to space. But there's been some good ones. I'm not enjoying the newer ones as much because they pushed it more of an action, where I'm more of a planner type of guy. I like to pause the action. I love RTSs for that same reason, the ones that you can pause and kind of give orders and then resume.
Well, did you like Dragon Age? Did you try that game out?
I did try the first Dragon Age, and it was pretty good, actually. I liked the magic system. I thought that was kind of a nice design. I like the interface because I was using the PC version for controlling the battles. That was pretty good. And the storytelling wasn't as good as it had been in the past, so I was kind of a little worried about that. And then I played Mass Effect, and I thought that the storytelling had really dropped in quality from BioWare. And then I started Mass Effect 2, and I just couldn't go any further.
Well, whatever you do, don't play Dragon Age 2. Like, that's probably my biggest day one purchase regret that I've made, because you're talking about dropping storytelling, it dropped it into hell, let me tell you. So, I mean, I think
thanks
the worst...
Thanks for the warning.
What's that?
I said thanks for the warning. I'm kind of gotten over BioWare at this point. I'm looking forward to the Chris Avellone Kickstarter game.
Was that the Project Eternity one or the Planescape?
Both.
Yeah, I'm backing them both, so I'm for it.
And they've got the Wasteland one, too. Wasteland 2, that's what it's called?
Yeah. And excellent. Shadowrun Returns, I think, is supposed to come out, I think, in August at this point? Yeah.
I already have, no, the end of this month, July 26th. So I already have, they actually sent me a key already, so I'm ready. I'm ready for that game.
Lucky dog.
Totally worth it. This is why I get on the Kickstarter projects, because it's like a nice surprise later. You're like, oh man, I forgot I backed this game up. Sweet, now I have a key. So.
Yeah, the ones that I've Kickstarted so far, they're still way in development. Stonehearth, Planetary Annihilation, the Double Fine Adventure game. I'm really looking forward to Planetary Annihilation because I'm the same way with my strategy games. I prefer the more macro-oriented ones other than like the StarCraft, you know, very micro-click-intensive ones. So I just find that my brain just completely spazzes out while I'm trying to focus on hotkey management and what's going on back in my base.
Well, you mentioned another Kickstarter before the Planetary Annihilation.
Stonehearth.
Oh, yes, the Banner Saga. That's the one I wanted to... I'm kind of looking forward to seeing what they do with that.
That animation is so beautiful. It's like one of the most fluid animations I've seen in 2D.
Yeah, one of the few times I jumped on a Kickstarter just because of the art style.
So my question is, what Kickstarters have you backed up that you remember?
I haven't backed many, and I've backed a lot fewer these days. But I did do the Banner Saga and Loser Suit Larry because I know Al. And if I'd known in advance, I would have backed the Traveler 5 RPG rule set. Although I hear it's not very good, which is sad. I'm trying to think of some other Kickstarters I've done that I've received even. This was Indiegogo, actually. It was Dominique Pomplemousse. Not Over Till the Fat Lady Sings. What a fun, fun game. It's just a joyous game to play.
Yeah, I think I've only backed one Indiegogo project. That was a fighting game called Skullgirls. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Those two. Usually people don't want to stick to one, but it's interesting to do both.
I remember seeing there was another Sierra veteran who had Kickstarter. I think it was Roberta Williams. I think she did a few months ago. I forget for what series, though.
I don't think it was Roberta. I think it was Lori and Corey Cole. They have their Heroes Quest.
That's
that. And I also think that, I'm going to forget her name, but she did the the noir magic Sierra game, detective guy, vampire, werewolf.
Gabriel Knight?
Gabriel Knight, that's it.
Yay, I knew it.
Some Kickstarter recently, and she's working on a game called Grey Matter. Anyway.
Well, wait, is it going to be FMV style, or is it going to be 3D?
It's not FMV. I'm sure it's going to be 2.5D.
I wonder how well a project that had FMVs would do.
Well, there's actually one. I think it just got Kickstarter for Tex Murphy. It's going to be a new FMV Tex Murphy game.
That's what I was about to say. Like, I want to play a new Tex Murphy game because that sounds hilarious and awesome at the same time. Just because FMVs to me are so hokey yet so interesting. Like, because you're really like trying to get around the hurdle of realism by using photographic imagery.
I still have like a lot of the Tom Vito games, ironically on the 3DO. I have Sewer Shard, Corpse Killer, Crypt Killer, one of those. And it does have like that certain charm to it, but like back then people were going like, this is going to be the future. We're never going to get any better than this.
That was the company I worked for, Digital Pictures. They produced Sewer Shark and Night Trap and several others. They did this really fun kung fu one where they literally got a film production unit in Hong Kong to do all the filming of it, and it turned out great as far as the FMV sequences go. I'm not sure if the gameplay was all that great, but it was totally that experience you're talking about.
Was that Kasumi Ninja?
No. What was it called? I'd have to Google for it. But yeah, Digital Pictures, Kung Fu, it'll come up fast, I'm sure.
So that whole era, like, did you ride that train of it being the future, or did you think it was a gimmick at the time?
I did think it was a gimmick. It was really hard to get the visual quality at full screen, and again, putting sprites over it to do the gameplay. It was really hard. We were really pushing our luck, and they actually knew this, and right before they kind of like were killed by their parent company, which was Acclaim at the time. They started doing very different designs for games. They put out like 8 designs to a public test to see what ones took. And we were just started on some really fresh games that, could have been really fun. There was some great storytelling there, and the crew was fantastic. Some of the best engineers I ever worked with. So I kind of had hopes, and then they were all crushed.
Did you ever play any of the like interactive adventure games like the Dragon's Lair, Space Ace, those types of games?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, they were fun, but they didn't really drag me into them. I couldn't sink a lot of quarters into those.
Yeah, me either. I thought the animation was amazing back then, thanks to Don Bluth who was doing that. But yeah, that whole genre eventually just phased out, and then we got all the QTEs in the last decade.
Right. Well, QuickTime events are okay. I was playing some Force Unleashed, and that was like the last thing I could actually succeed at was the hitting the one button really, really fast.
Force Unleashed recently?
I got a copy of it when I shipped Dangerous High School Girls in Trouble, the other nominees for the Writers Guild Award. I contacted them all and said, hey, let's trade games. And they did. It was really
nice.
Fun.
Interesting. I wonder what happened with the second one. That seemed like one of those, like to hear someone's ear about that fun, because that was a very rushed project. But the first one was like really well thought out and had a lot of engineers and stuff behind it.
I think that's sort of what you were talking about with Dragon Age, what happened between the first and second. They sort of rushed to get that second one out to market.
And Dragon Age was 3.5 years. The other one was like a year development or so.
Wow, that's pretty hard.
Well, their idea was, instead of like traveling to different places, let's have it travel within time. So we have one city with different ages,
mm-hmm.
right? Like 5 years. So if you can use the same assets. But it was so bad. Like, you would go into a cave. It would be like an underground dwarven lava temple. You would go underneath the town, you get the same level. You would go to someone's basement, it would be the same level. You're like, what is going on? Are they opening franchises? What is this? And that's what I'm like, man, they really cut corners with this game.
I'm going to be honest, I've never been a huge BioWare fan, just because I've always been more of a mechanic-focused person. And even though the BioWare games have great stories, I could just never get behind the more, I guess, the pen and paper style, their older games, like Baldur's Gate and Neverwinter Nights.
Neverwinter Nights is my favorite of all of them. That's the game I sunk the most hours in.
I prefer the Baldur's Gate trilogy. I actually was pleasantly surprised by Icewind Dale for basically a dungeon crawling game. They still had a fun little storyline that kind of helped things move along. They just seemed to have quality oozing out of their pores at that time.
Now, that was when they were considered Black Isle, or that was like a different studio?
Yeah, I think it was Black Isle's was the big force behind it.
That's one of the main Icewind Dale and the second one.
Going back to with the Kickstarters, one thing that I've noticed that has been doing a lot of great hitting their goals is the board game Kickstarters. I've been seeing, like, everyone that I've seen so far, they're asking for maybe like 50,000 or 100,000. They always get like 5 to 10 times that amount. So it seems that the board game genre has really gotten a huge hit thanks to Kickstarter.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was just well-known names, people like James Ernest, who has the Cheap Ass Games. He did a successful one recently too. Not everybody knows him, but that hardcore knot of gamers certainly will spend money for his game, whatever he describes it to be.
By the way, talking about board games. You said you're like an enthusiast. What have you jumped on any recent games that have come out?
I like the Spartacus game actually. I've been enjoying that. What have I played recently too? Now I have to like switch gears and go through the boxes that are sitting on the shelves that haven't been opened, and some that I've played in other places' houses and I bought and I haven't opened myself. A classic for me is Suro, T-S-U-R-O. It's a quick little game of placing tiles and your pawns move across these lines, and eventually you run out of space and everybody dies. It's just a cute little like 10-minute game that scales really well. 8 players, it still takes about 10 to 15 minutes to play.
Wow, that sounds pretty good. I mean, I've been getting into some of those, what would you call Ticket to Ride in Settlers of Catan? There's like a term for them.
I wouldn't. It's a board gamer.
Mainstream games?
I guess so. There's actually a convention in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. That's like the international board game ones. And last year was the first time I ever went to them. And let me tell you, there is hundreds and hundreds of unknown war games there that I've never heard, and they all look the same, and they all look really complicated. Like realistic World War II, World War I board games. Have you ever tried any of those?
I grew up playing the Avalon Hill war games, like Panzerblitz and Blitzkrieg and Kriegsspiel, and just dozens of those games. I was addicted at the time. I didn't play many of the SPI games. They always seemed a little, I don't know, not as well or designed or I don't know, the product quality didn't seem to be as high as Avalon Hill games, but it was quite an introduction to gaming for me when I was 14.
Have you ever played any of like the grand strategy games like Crusader Kings 2 or anything from like Paradox Interactive?
I played Cross of Iron for a while, and it was the micromanagement that started getting to me. It's one of my dreads about Civ. I love playing Civ, but after a while, to beat the higher levels, you just have to get into such micromanagement that it kind of loses your focus of like what you're really enjoying about the game.
Which still be talking about? You're talking about the board game one or the digital one?
The digital one. The board game one is fine. I really like that game. It keeps things very abstracted and there's no micromanaging really. But the computer game is, I mean, if you're going to play it seriously, you've got to be able to like know exactly each crop on every city, every square, what should be being grown and decided. It's a harsh, or not harsh, but a demanding game.
Well, they changed the game again with the new expansion, Brave New World.
Yeah, I think they got rid of some of that. I haven't played the higher levels of 5, but I haven't got any of the DLC yet either. So.
Well, they changed it up a lot. Because the second one, they added religion and a bunch of other mechanics and spies and stuff, like still technology. And the new one, they talk about trade routes and a bunch of other stuff, too. So they really keep revamping their system for each DLC.
Yeah, going back to where you just said regarding the min-max, that's always been a real killer for playing any game. When it gets to that point where the only way for me to win is to completely disregard story, theme, just go, I won't get exactly +5 of this, +7 of that. And just min-max at that level, just gets to a point where it feels less like I'm playing a game, more like I'm just like working or doing like a spreadsheet.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It feels like work.
Now that's actually a good question. I want to go back for your titles. With 7 Grand Steps, there's a lot of the elements of the game that are hidden from the player. Like you don't know how many profession icons or tokens you need to give to a child, raise them up, or exactly what some of your choices will make. When you're balancing the mechanics out, how do you decide, I guess, how clear you make these mechanics and how much you hide it behind the lore or the theme of the world?
Yeah, that's a real tough call, and I don't think I actually do it as good as it could be done. It's a tough call because I'm trying to be inclusive with my design such that you know, someone who isn't that much of a gamer might be kind of sucked into the simple gameplay of moving the pawns around the wheel, and then slowly they kind of build this very simple model of the game that they're playing, and they're having fun. I really hope I can do that for some people. And then the hardcore gamers who want to spend the time, you know, go into that, hit that I button, and learn all the rules. There's a lot of details in the in-game instructions.
Yeah, definitely. A friend was telling me while I was playing it, I had a friend doing it at the same time. He was like, oh, I'm at, like, the kingdom management screen. I'm managing all these kingdoms. Like, what? Where are you at? Like, oh, yeah, it's at the top. Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. I'm still trying to get my guys up to the third class.
Yeah, that was a surprise for me as well. I was getting tired of doing all the writing for the first age. I had been working on it for, like, a year. And I just said, oh, I've got to write all these stories again for the ruling class. And then I thought, well, what if I didn't have stories here and instead put a little mini game out, you know, something simple like the original Hammurabi. That'd be really cool. And that kind of grew into a little bit more of a larger mini game. And it became a rather interesting little exercise in how to balance a 20 variable a simulation system. And like, then I knew all the hell that Will Wright had suffered for the first SimCity.
Now, with Seven Grand Steps, where did the original concept for that game come from?
That's my favorite story. Is I had finished Dangerous High School Girls in Trouble, and I was just doing promotions for it, and I had some money, so I bought myself a new laptop, and it was the first Macintosh I had that could play Civ 4, as far as a laptop goes. And so I played Civ 4 for a month, and I just kind of got to that point where I was really having fun, but after a while it was like, okay, I'm getting tired of this, and I couldn't beat the higher levels, plus this whole, like you said, work and micromanagement. And I was trying to think back, well, what was it I really liked about the game? And that was kind of an impetus, and then it made me remember these books by Edward Rutherford. He wrote Sarum and Ruska and several other books that take place in a very specific place on the Earth, but over, you know, like thousands of years following a few family lines. And those books are terrific fun, and I just thought that would be an interesting game to actually take civilization and play it from the perspective of a family trying to survive it and actually, you know, have generations that made it across all the terrible things that happened in history.
Yeah, and it definitely has that interesting. I like how you have all these different, like, the quests you were talking about. When I was talking to a few friends, they were sort of relating it to the game King of Dragon Pass. Did you ever play that game?
Oh yes, it was a inspiration as well. I actually know the developer David Dunham, and I walked up to him one day and said, "I'm stealing your game," and he said, "You bet! It's about time someone did."
Yeah,
that's just a small part of Seven Grand Steps. The little heroic adventures are really the only big crossover that's clear between the two games.
Yeah, King of Dragon Pass is one of those games that I'm surprised we haven't seen anyone try to make, like, a modern-day version of that. We had XCOM last year, which I thought was okay, but was somewhat limited. But I know with King of Dragon Pass, they have the mobile version that I think they did refinements with that one.
That I think he did refine it. It was probably hard for him, because I'm not sure he still has the money to, like, redo, like, the artwork. And then the underlying simulation is pretty harsh. It totally beats the crap out of the little mini-games at the top of the Seven Grand Steps, but it's a hard system to run, and the game world is based on some, what was it, miniature system? I can't remember what the game world was based on, but it's pretty baroque.
Definitely. With Seven Grand Steps, how long did it take you to actually design the game? So I know that you've been working on it for a few years.
The design came together over the first year before I started doing any storytelling for it. I tried several core mechanics, trying to get a sense for how do you play. Or how do you give people a sense that they're striving in life? And eventually I stumbled on this one mechanic that I thought was a good choice for it. And then everything else kind of fell together fairly quickly after that. I knew I kind of wanted to have storytelling, and it all fit together within a few months once I finally got to that core mechanic. And then I had to start the writing effort, which is the bulk of the work.
From when you first started coming with the game to when you got the core mechanic, were there any changes to the game from when you first started to when it eventually ended up, or did everything basically stay the same through the design process?
We switched up some of the orientation. The wheel was upside down originally. It was that different orientation. And there was a couple other things that changed, but not really. I was really struck by how strong the core mechanic held up for repetitive play. That was my biggest worry. And it's still not perfect, but if people just approach it as more of a casual game where they just play a little bit at a time, there's just nothing else like it. So, like, it's not like we're ripping off some of the clone and people are saying, I've seen this gameplay before. It's always this, you know, well, I go to this game to play this specific mechanic.
Speaking about the wheel, that's another thing that I found really great about Sega Grand Tales was the overall aesthetic style of being like one of those really old token arcade machines. Was that an original concept when you came with it, or did that develop over the course of making the game?
That was recommended by the art director. This is the first time I actually had a game where I kind of like had an art director who took the reins and said, we're going to make it look like this. And he just had the great idea of going to the Museum of Mechanics in San Francisco, which I'd been to before. But when he said it, I kind of realized this is where we need to go. And we visited and took pictures and brought them all back. And he came up with his initial designs for the box and the wheels. And I brought in another artist to help him. And yeah, I'm really pleased with the art in the game.
My favorite part, which I was when I was still playing with the same friend that we discovered, was when you put your mouse over the alligators or crocodiles in the bottom left. They each had their little name and backstory. I was like, dude, put your mouse over them. See what they do. He goes, holy crap, they actually have little stories down there.
Yeah, I love adding little things like that to the games. There's a lot of little stuff. It's even I can't even remember it all, but it's fun when it comes back and I realize, oh, I put this in there just because I thought it would be funny. Like, you know, I don't know if you've grown your kids ever to have a skill greater than AAA.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I heard this one. I haven't done it yet, but I know what you're talking about. If you want to explain it to everyone who's listening, go right ahead.
My fear of hubris is a problem, but basically, I was telling some friends here that the game just ends at AAA, and someone else said, well, what's better than AAA? And then the guy next to him said indie. So we've got an indie level for kids.
Yeah, awesome. With the actual game mechanics, with the children itself, how did you come up with like this whole concept of balancing having, you know, few children, having, you know, high stats versus having different families when you have like 6 or 7 children and then you're forced to switch between who's going to be, you know, the star child of the family?
Yeah, that was pretty straightforward. I mean, it basically, like, how many kids could the machine actually physically represent? Because, you know, clearly people are having like 10 and 15 kids a lot of times. But I want to have that sense at least to have, like, lots of kids, you know, the old rule 1, 2, 3, many. You know, I just wanted to have enough so it felt like, God, I've got a lot of kids, you know. And I think seven fit the role for that. And then I just balanced the creation of tokens such that you could basically educate them fair or a few very well. There proved to be another factor, like here's a tip. If you teach kids all the same technology in the same turn, they get a bonus. So I've done this, if you don't chase after beads and you just concentrate on making tokens and feeding the kids, that trick will actually bring all the kids up to at least an A.
Nice. We should probably advertise over this cast. We got strategies for 7 grand steps.
There's a lot to it, actually. I'm still amazed that people play the game differently than I ever imagined. I had this one woman just kind of like play it like, I don't know, I kind of liken it to a racing game. She didn't care how well the kids turned out. She just wanted to have kids, get to that next generation, and start another family. She was just bizarre, but man, she's just having a blast.
Yeah, with mine, I still haven't gone to the actual city match. The best I've gotten was the third class on the wheel. Now, another part of the game, one of the major aspects are the hero quests or the challenges you can go after, the invention, go on a quest, or rise up in the social class. When you were balancing that out, what was your general thought process for, I guess, player progression in the game?
I wish I could have thought of more types of goals to have. Having 3 goals was like a minimum. So when your family is striving for something, I was trying to think of things that would kind of like give your sense that the family had achieved something great, you know, and a discovery is certainly there, and heroics are certainly there, and rising in society is certainly there. I just wish I'd come up with more. I mean, I guess I could have taken a religious route, but that might have gotten weird, and who knows where that would have gone as far as, you know, impressions.
Now, one of the other aspects behind 7 Grand Steps is, of course, when you were billing it to Steam, and what fans have heard is that this is the first part of what you're hopefully planning to be, obviously, 7 or 6 more steps. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, if the game sells well, what you're planning for in the future of 7 Grand Steps?
Yeah, I kind of liken it actually to the Total War series, where each game is very complete in its own right, but it covers one period of history. And then so the next game would cover a different section of history. I will link them, so the next game, if I do end up having enough money to make it, will find a special file that was created when you complete the first game and carry your family over, but it won't be exactly the same. It'll just have information about the family. It won't actually allow you to, like, go into the graveyard of the previous game or anything like that, that kind of depth. But, yeah, it basically you just will continue on into a new period with new stories and new culture. There'll probably be a few changes to the gameplay to reflect how society changed. I did that a little bit. I don't know if you've noticed the difference between the social classes in the Copper Age and the social classes in the Bronze Age, but they're very distinctly different. The social classes really stratified strongly in the Bronze Age, where there's a little bit more egalitarian in the Copper Age. So that's reflected in the gameplay by when you use a token to go up to a level higher than you're currently on, you can be rejected in the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, but it won't be a problem in the Copper Age.
Yeah, I noticed that on my first family, that actually screwed me because I stored all my higher age tokens, and then when I failed the age challenge, I went down a class. So all I had was the third social class tokens, and they kept rejecting me. I'm like, nuts. I had nothing to do but kept getting sent back to the crocodile at that point.
I'm crying.
With each period, like if we do get to the point where you're able to develop each next step, will there be any like radical changes, or will it still follow the same basic gameplay of the wheel motif?
Yeah, I'm planning to continue the core mechanic. One of the reasons is that it is unique. There isn't a game out there that has the same core mechanic. So, I mean, it takes a long time to write the stories. It'll take 2 years when I start writing stories to complete just the storytelling for the next game. There'll be art changes and other superficial changes, but the core mechanic will stay. It'll be largely the same game, but 2 years from now, people may come back to it and it'll feel fresh again because, you know, there's no other way to play that mechanic unless you just want to keep playing the old one, which I think people will stop after 2 years.
Now, one thing that you're talking about regarding when you're transitioning from the first to the seventh step is keeping elements from the first game to the second one. And that's one of those very interesting things. We saw that with The Walking Dead, with how your choices have slight variations with each episode. That's pretty much an interesting mechanic we don't see normally in just about any game. Do you see yourself carrying that trend or through all the steps, or do you think that will reach a point of just there's just too many things to keep track of?
We do that in a limited, almost Easter egg sort of way. There are events that occur in the Ancients game that actually will set a flag that can be caught later on in the game. So, like, one of the examples I have is one of, I think it's the Artisan class challenge in the Bronze Age. No, it's in the Copper Age, because you're making a pot, and your family has basically become one of the best potters in the whole area. And everything's collapsing, the barbarians are invading, the city's being destroyed, and all this guy is doing, the head of the family is doing, is just working on his last pot, which will be his masterpiece, and the family buries it, and then they all get killed. Oh. And then, hopefully, I was kind of thinking, like, you know, if you ever make it to like the 50s or the 30s, you know, one of your occupations might be an archaeologist and you find the pot.
Nice.
So there's stuff like that in there, but yeah, I didn't go excessive with it.
Now, what we were talking about earlier regarding the rise of Kickstarter and crowdfunding, have you considered taking 7 Grand Steps to a crowdfunding site?
I don't think my ability to attract enough audience to support the Kickstarter successfully. It's going to need about $100,000 to be a real successful, and I think it's possible if it sells well on the casual sites. I'm kind of hoping that's where my big focus is now. It's done okay on Steam, but it hasn't really recouped much more than my out-of-pocket costs and some fun money. So we'll see where we get to. It's close. We'll see. I have hopes, but right now I can't be sure, and I don't think Kickstarter is an answer that I can pursue. I had a few friends that did successful Kickstarters, but I saw them go through hell, and it's just not the kind of work that I'm really good at. You know, I have trouble like trying to reach out to people and convince them, no, this is a really cool game. You know.
Well, how about the other route, selling alpha or beta for a game? Have you thought about doing that for future projects?
I had a beta sale for this game, and it was pretty successful, but it wouldn't have earned enough money to really build the whole game. So very early ones, again. And then you've got storytelling happening, which was my biggest concern. When I sold the beta, largely all the storytelling had been written. We were just editing at that point. But earlier, then you've got this weird cutoff of the writing and the story. And then if you start again later on, it's kind of a little too much of the same. You're like, you're starting to have to read the book over again. You know, that kind of worries me that the kind of product just isn't right for that sort of really early sort of releasing. And that's another issue with the Kickstarters, is that this game doesn't sell well visually. If you take a look at the videos we made the best ones we could, but you look at them and say, well, that's kind of interesting, but I have no idea what's going on. Because clearly the gameplay's in the head. Anyone who's played it knows. And that's the hard thing, is just getting someone to download and play the game. I think we'll be successful on casual because that is the model. People expect to have to download and play the game. So I'm really hopeful that we'll catch a lot more on the casuals than we actually are on Steam.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a visual guy. So when I saw the trailer, I kind of got what the mechanics were, but I didn't actually get the whole of what the gameplay really were to offer. But but there's other developers that we've talked to, and other developers, other games that are out there that do make the mistake of not having any sort of any visual flair at all, and then they wonder why their sales dips, because first impressions is just very important too. But I think that your game has enough fidelity to kind of garner interest.
Yeah, I think with talking about first impressions, I think that's a major issue that we're seeing with the digital market. As we talked about, I think, very early in this cast, how easy and natural it's been to switch to digital and how quick to buy games. At the same time, when you have, hundreds and hundreds of games vying for your attention, you really need to hit someone within like the first 30 seconds to a minute of looking at your game in order for them to decide whether or not they're going to continue playing.
Yeah, just getting out there in front of people is hard. I rely a lot these days on the video bloggers. Seem to have a large audiences that which will swarm. Whereas even the best journalists, Rock Paper Shotgun, can't touch like a Northern Lion. It's kind of sad. But I still love the journalists too. So just trying to get the attention of large groups of people is hard. There's Reddit. There's I'm trying to think of some other sites that people visit to check out new games. But you're right. It's all about, here's some art, here's some concept art. Yeah, that looks kind of cool. And like, here's some working examples. And then like, here's an actual video of the gameplay. And if every one of them proceeds to like grab their attention and say like, oh, I get it. I want to play that, then you're golden, I think.
That's how important editing is and presentation is. And there's some games that just pull me, not even on their visuals alone, but their presentation and their music. Like, I think Transistor. Like, it hasn't come out yet, but that music alone makes me want to buy the game for that soundtrack. And Banner Saga, again, that animation was so fluid, I didn't even know what the game was about, and I still want it. So, like, that kind of stuff is really important, And I think that's what we need to put more, not saying marketing, but presentation is very important to separate yourself from the other developers.
Yeah, I want to reiterate what you said about audio. I think audio is incredibly important in video games. The drawback for this board game stuff that I've got is that board games are more in your head kind of gameplay as opposed to visual gameplay. You look at people playing Settlers of Catan, you have no clue what they're doing, but clearly it's an awesome game.
Right, and it wouldn't have such a following if it wasn't fun. So word of mouth is also very important too.
Definitely. Yep. Yeah, we're seeing the same thing. Ken and I were talking about this last week regarding just general like news and publications out there. We've reached a point of just oversaturation that is very hard for a site to survive when you have 20 and 30 other places reporting the same exact news.
So yeah, it's about finding a niche, and it's about finding a group, and also knowing what kind of information that would make you stand out from the rest too. And I think development is definitely having, at least because it's so easy to release now, without all the limitations of the past, that we are getting oversaturated.
And we're getting oversaturated with good games. There's so many developers, and there's a lot of talent that has learned a lot over the last 5 years even. There's an amazing number of good games, so it's very competitive.
Yeah, and then there's also, I also feel like there's a lot of really bad games that confuse people. Because you look at Xbox Live Arcade, that is atrocious in terms of what they allow to release and what they don't allow to be released. So I had a friend who released a game on Xbox Live, and it was like in its early days, and he sold like 40 copies of it or something crazy like that. But a game where you play a unicorn that spins in circles sold like 100,000. So he was very, dispirited from all that, from that experience of working on Xbox Live.
Yeah. I think you're talking about XBLIG and not XBLA.
That's what I meant. The other one, the indie one, the smaller one.
Yeah, that's just a reflection of a uncurated market, just like the iPad. You know, you look on the list of new iPad games every day, and they're just horrible. And then every now and then you hear of a good one.
You know, it's worse than that. Android Marketplace.
I think they're fairly equal.
I don't know. Well, I think in terms of at least our research, that you know, the turnover rate and people willing to pay more money is on the iStore, which is why you get such popularity there. But like, it's really like the Wild West on the Android store. You're really taking a risk you're developing for it.
Yeah, I actually would love to put 7 Grand Steps on tablet. I think it actually would be a better experience. I think anyone who's played it would know why or can see why. Definitely. But I couldn't take that risk.
Oh, why? Too much of a cost?
Starting out on iPad and trying to get the attention for a game that isn't have as an immediate visual sort of hook, other than just being pretty, you know? It's my cat.
Well, maybe a port over would make sense, right? Because you build an audience already. Porting it over, people probably would love it.
Yeah, and that's the plan. It'll be another way I can hopefully get enough money to start working on a future product.
I'll put it on the Rift. Do it that way.
It's 3D.
It's cool for you.
Real overkill.
It would be totally worth it.
Have you considered getting on Good Old Games, or is 7 Grand Steps on Good Old Games right now?
I haven't approached them yet. They didn't want Dangerous High School Girls, so I'm a little concerned they won't like this one, but I think this is a little bit more along their lines. So I just haven't got to them yet. I'm concentrating on the casual game portals right now.
Oh, yeah. Which ones are you focusing on?
Big Fish is still the best player to So, I mean, just in terms of numbers. And they're actually very developer-friendly. I've had good relations with them. I just need to get the product to suit their requirements. They're not quite Microsoft, but they do have some stringent requirements as far as the interface and how the game works and limitations.
Yeah, speaking of Good Old Games, they have definitely changed their ship over the last few years. When they were first out, they were, of course, nothing but classic games. And now they're starting to release more modern games. They're starting to do, like, releasing, like, day one games as well. So it has been a change for them, which I think has happened with the digital marketplace. With all these different competitors, it's getting to the point where even the different stores are competing for your attention now.
I hope so. The hardest part is that Steam is the giant elephant that's rampaging thing. And Good Old Games, I talked to other developers who have their titles on Good Old Games, and it's actually number two or close to it. There's just, like, Impulse is dead, Direct-to-Drive is dead. I mean, Gamer's Gate isn't doing very well. It's just hard to find competition, which I dearly want. I love Steam, and they're fabulous people. They've been so beneficent as far as how they run their thing for developers. But that could change, and that would be really bad.
Well, what about Green Man Gaming? Are they as bad as Gamer's Gate? I wonder.
I don't think they've been rising that well either. I don't even like Apple's new Mac Store. I don't think people are selling nearly as much as they sold previously when they just had a web page that they kind of simply curated. It was pretty great. I sold a lot of copies of Dangerous High School Girls off that. But as far as I can tell, people selling games on the Mac Store aren't doing as well.
Wait, so are you all... You should probably actually look at some of the metrics for that, too, and see why. Maybe it's a design problem. Maybe it's a function problem. But so you are on GOG?
No, I'm not on
GOG. Because I think that would be a perfect match for your game because, you know, you have ties to Sierra and Adventure Games in the past, and they're all about old school games. So you could really do if they do a spotlight on you or something like that, that would help you sell a ton of copies. Because the audience that would love your games are definitely on GOG over Steam. Steam is definitely great, but GOG is way in your alley. So if you can get in bed with them, I think you're well off.
Well, I'll be contacting them soon. I hope to wrap up this Big Fish issues this week, possibly, and then move quickly to other portals.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I think GOG is just growing because they are entering a market that wasn't spoken for before, which is just these old games, these old forgotten games, and making them accessible and playable on new machines, quad processors.
Now, what's interesting is with Steam, they were the first big digital retailer, so they were able to get all the contracts and all the games that way. And with GOG, they were the first one to do classic games, so that allowed them to get those rights and those licenses easier. So it's definitely a case where it really comes down to the first guy on the market. And I think that's one of the things that we're seeing is hurting all these other stores. Like when you have Origin, Impulse, and the other ones who are basically just copying Steam, they're not really providing anything new to excite people to get them to Switch.
And people don't want to also download another DRM system on top of Steam already. Like, I've heard many, many times people avoiding games entirely from EA because they don't want to download Origin. Like, if you want to play Dragon Age 2, you'd have to download Origin. Do you want to do that? No one wants to do that.
Nope. No one wants to do that. Yeah, I agree. That's why Good Old Games just sells you DRM-free copies, right? You just put them in a folder.
And you still get a library, too, so it's great. You can always go back and download it, and they give you wallpapers and music and a bunch of other stuff with it, too, and the manuals. Way easier than Steam.
Yeah, Humble is even easier. They just give you the files, but you can keep going back to them. So.
Yeah, and again, it's a service problem mostly. Like, people pirate games just because they maliciously want to hurt the developer. It's just that they're having a hard time obtaining the game itself sometimes, especially something like Origin. Like, I really wanted to play Kingdoms of Amalur, right? And I'm just waiting for the Steam sale for it because I see it going so cheap on Origin for like $7, but again, I have to download Origin, play it.
Right.
It's totally not worth saving $7.
Now, with piracy, there are, of course, like, I know a few people back in the day who they would just pirate any game, didn't matter quality or how much, they just pirated just to pirate it. And I think that was back then where we had that layer of you didn't really know developers or what the kinds of things they do. But these days, with the in-pen market, a lot of times you can attach a name and a face to a game. I think that sort of, I wouldn't say it kills piracy, but it's sort of, it's like casual piracy. I guess it sort of stops that, in my opinion.
I think putting the face on the game does help, especially for independent developers. People, you know, think more about the personal connection that they're having through a pirated copy. And I actually was worried. I was Googling for my game. I do this regularly just to see what kind of talk is happening about it. And I saw this mention of like, hey, does anyone know where I can get a pirated copy of it? And like, nobody answered him. And I wondered, is nobody pirating my game? Is that a bad thing? You know, what, maybe people don't like my game enough to pirate it. I mean, is that where we've gone? There's so many games out there that the pirates can't keep up.
I think in that case, they just don't want to, because they know what the game's tied to. Do you really want to take money from a guy that deserves it? Because, like, it's easy for people to pirate games from giant entities like EA, right? They feel less guilt. But if it's a person and just like a single developer, it's a lot more, you feel like you're really robbing something legitimate, right?
Well, I think you're talking about a kernel of truth, but I think in general there's just pirates that just want to grab every copy of whatever it is. I know for certain that if your game goes up on a certain place like Steam, they automatically pirate it. It's just, again, it's set up to do that. It largely has to do with selling games in Asia, actually. You buy a whole disc of games, and they've all been pirated, of course, but they only paid like 50 cents for the disc. But then, you know, that was like 40 cents profit to the pirate, you know, or it's crazy, but that's why those systems still exist.
Well, that's not really a problem of games. It's a problem of all things in Asia, right? Because a lot of weird console bans and bans of this and that. So they made their own system around it. So you find knockoffs of any product in existence. The whole gray market is a big thing over there. But I don't know if that's your audience, though, so you should not have to worry about
Well, of course, it's a very complex issue, and I don't really care about the Asian market. My game is about Western civilization only because I actually know a little bit about Western civilization, whereas I don't know much about Asian culture, but I really love it. I'm a huge anime fan, especially. You know, and I would have loved to find some, you know, Asian indie developer who would say like, yeah, I'll make a 7 Grand Steps for the Eastern side, and that would be so cool.
Hey, it's possible. I mean, they're especially like Singapore, them all rising up, and there are definitely new developers of different countries are coming up fruition. But again, there's, you know, a few people spoil like the bunch, so everyone assumes that everyone in Asia is a bunch of people that pirate. But so there's some legitimate customers there too, and they're just being deprived of the ability to obtain the games, which is why they have to go to piracy, which is evil. But it's kind of like the way that they've been skewed, you know.
Oh yeah, I know.
But again, like for independent developers and concept of ease of use, I think these new services like GOG, Steam are really great. I want to see a third competitor pop open to the fray and see what they can offer. But I worry about GameStop. I mean, I don't worry about them, but I wonder what's going to happen to them. Are they going to go the way of Blockbuster?
Could be. I mean, when they bought, I think it was DirectDrive is the one they bought, or did they buy Impulse? But
they
anyway, clearly,
Impulse, yeah.
Well, clearly they weren't able to like bring enough eyeballs to those pages to sell games, because I had Dangerous High School Girls on both of them, and all the sales just died. And now I'm getting letters from them saying that we're out of business. So.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think stay away from them, I guess.
I think the problem with having a third competitor is, as we talked about earlier, what can someone else bring to Steam or bring against Origin that they haven't already done or thought of?
Present, past, future. Go future.
I think Steam has actually future-proofed itself with what Gabe Newell was talking about, the open store, where there will be multiple stores out there. And the way it'll happen is it'll be themes. I don't know if you've seen these, on Greenlight, they have this thing called collections, or it's not communities, it might be collections, but it's literally you out there in your personal presence saying, I'm making a collection and these are the games I like. And you're just grabbing a bunch of Greenlight games and putting them together in one to one heading. And people say, oh, that's a heading I'm interested in. And they get to see all the games. Do finger the same way with the store on Steam, where there'll be all these storefronts, you know, would have very special niche sort of like attraction, and now more games will sell than ever before. I think Steam is brilliant with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually very similar to Workshop. That's exactly what Workshop does too. They have a bunch of mods you can download for a game, but it's collections, so you can say, I want to download them all. And it makes sense, because you know how successful Humble Bundle was, and all those bundle sites now, and how that really helps spike sales. It'll do the same kind of thing if you think about that in terms of collection. So, good idea. I think that's definitely the way to go.
Now, at the beginning of the cast, you were talking about how you're finishing up getting the cards for 7 Grand Steps. What are your thoughts on the whole trading card system for Steam? Because that's something that pretty much came very quickly in terms of development, and it's definitely catching a lot of eyes and attention. I know a lot of my friends have mixed feelings about whether or not it really is adding anything to Steam or just to general gameplay.
Well, I've got a personal story to tell about that, and it has to do with before Steam announced the trading cards. In the San Francisco Bay Area, I'm involved with a group of other independent developers that are producing products. And we thought it would be really cool if we built these little trading cards of all our products and the artwork on them, and it'd be like, here, meet the indies and collect the cards and collect all of them. And like, we never followed through with that idea. So it's like, so that hurts. But to answer your question, I actually think trading cards are a gimmick, and they'll probably die out like green stamps and gold stamps did in the 70s. But it'll take a while to die out. It's still fun. People love collecting stuff. There'll be crazy people who will collect forever. And for me, it was like a no-brainer, because it was something that was external to my game. I didn't have to like make API calls to Steam to do anything. I just created a bunch of art. I submitted it to the game site, and it's going to come out. And it's like, great. I didn't have to mess with my game to make it work. So that was like, I had to jump on that as quickly as possible, but I still was too slow. I mean, it was, oh well.
I see people popping up in old games all the time of the last couple of days just because of those cards. So, I mean, I think they're actually making a pretty big impact. And the whole treasure hunt concept, I think that's what people love about it too. There's a little sense of adventure.
Sure.
I still think that their best success in terms of like the gimmick was the Steam Summer Sale, where they had exclusive Summer Sale achievements that you could then trade in for DLC or various stuff of your choosing.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I kind of liked the idea of some of the bundles they were selling too, where they would sell like three games, buy three games at once and then send them off to friends. So you pay a little bit more, but clearly the developers were going to make more money because they ended up selling more games that way.
Ken, so what do you think? Do you think the trading cards is going to hang around, or do you think it's more on the same lines as a gimmick?
I think it's going to get refined. I think right now it's experimental, but there's definitely because look at TF2, look how popular and, successful the hat system has been, for that game. I think they could do the same thing as a whole for the card system. Again, but they're going to have a lot of pitfalls, but I think it's probably something that will last longer in one form or another.
I think with the trading card system myself, I think I'm more on Keith's side as well. If you look at the graphs they have, like if you try to sell a card, you see the trending graph of how much people are spending. As more people are getting the cards, they are selling for far less. I'm seeing cards for like 10 cents, $0.55 when 2 weeks ago they were $0.40, $0.50. Someone actually spent like $10 on a car at one point, which was just crazy for me.
Yeah. When I was in the early 90s, when Magic the Gathering first came out, I got addicted to that game fast. And I literally was buying boxes of booster packs at a time in order to basically collect four of every card. And I did that for several years. And at one point, I kind of looked around and I saw the prices that these cards had. And I went like, you know, this is paper. They can print more. I sold everything I had. I made like $6,000 profit, you know.
Wow.
Years. So it was just a crazy pricing for the cards. And now they're a little bit less ridiculous.
Oh, it's even easier to sell these cards too. You don't have to go anywhere. Just right click sell done.
Yeah, that's something. But again, they'll keep printing more and more, and overall the values will go down.
Well, yeah. And they have the holographic ones too. So I haven't seen one.
Are you talking about the foil cards?
Yeah,
but you've got the rift, so you get to see the cool holograph in like 3D.
Yeah, there you go. It's totally worth it. Mm-hmm.
I still haven't seen a foil card either. Well, I got my first booster set on Steam. It was just three duplicates of a card I already had. It's like, damn, I should have sold that.
I want a booster. I didn't get one of those yet either.
You have to complete you have to get all the card drops from a game to have a chance of getting a booster for it.
Okay.
Most people are just leaving games on, like going away and letting the cards just tally up that way. Someone showed me a screenshot from his computer. He just had five games running the same. I was like, all right, I'm done. I'm just going to leave. I'll be back and get all the cards later.
Like Bitcoin mining.
Way to go. Well, I mean, it's just equivalent to like those idle servers on TF2. You get the hats. Same concept.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for that moment where the price are going to go a little bit. And then I'm just going to mass sell all the cards I don't want, even hopefully make a few bucks.
Now, those are virtual bucks. You just buy games with them, right?
Yeah, they're basically the Steam cred or the Steam wallet. All right, so I think we can start wrapping it up now. Ken, do you have any other questions you'd like to ask Keith?
Nope.
So with that case, I think we're going to end it here. Keith, it was great talking to you, and hopefully we can talk to you again with you planning the second 7 Grand Steps.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed talking with you.
It was great, and as always, for those of you listening, if you would like to be a future guest on the cast or could submit a piece for the site, you can find a link to our email under Submissions Wanted. And thanks, Keith, for being on the cast this week. And as always, Ken, thanks for being my co-host.
No problem.
I really enjoyed it.
All right. So we're going to end it here. As always, have a great weekend. Hopefully, we'll all still have some money after the Steam summer sale.
Yeah.
And have a great weekend. We will talk to you again next time. Take care, everyone.
Good night.